How many proposals does it take to get to the center of the property tax problem? You're listening to SDPB's In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Legislators have until Monday to submit draft requests for bills and resolutions to the Legislative Research Council. That means more property tax relief proposals are still in the pipeline. I welcomed Lieutenant Governor Tony Venhuizen to the SDN Communications Studio in SDPB Studios in the Capitol Building and Pier. We had a conversation about property taxes and economic development.
You know, it's still pretty early in the session. There are a lot of different ideas and bills floating around. Some have been filed, some I've heard about that have not been filed. By the end of this week is the deadline for unlimited bill filing. And then next week is the final deadline. So we should know by next week exactly what all the ideas are. But I think we're at the point right now where we're still kind of getting the lay of the land of what the ideas are and where people are at. The governor's plan has been getting a lot of support, I would say, and certainly interest even from people who aren't ready to commit. His idea would be to let each county make its own decision on an optional up to half-cent sales tax, either by the commission or by the voters by petition, with that money going to owner-occupied property tax relief. His feeling is that, and if you look at the state, this is clearly true. There are some areas of the state where property taxes on homeowners have gone up a lot, and others where they really haven't. And the governor's view is that a statewide solution doesn't make as much sense given that reality, that allowing it to be targeted in the areas where it's become more of a problem is a better approach. But a lot of ideas out there, and that means that the legislators are all, I don't want to say fractured exactly, but there's a lot of different plans, and people like different plans, and some of them contradict each other. Another nice thing about the governor's plan is it is consistent with other plans. Some of these other plans contradict each other. Okay. You couldn't do them both because they're spending the same money twice or they're doing the same thing. The governor's plan can work with any of the others, which makes it a little more flexible as we get into these discussions.
What levers does state government have? Because property taxes are often a local issue. So what can you do?
In a given year, if we wanted to cut property taxes this year, you can do that one of three ways. You can actually just cut the property tax rates, which means that local governments get less money. State government doesn't get a dime of property tax. That's got to say that up front. This is cities, counties, and schools almost entirely. So you can cut property taxes, which means they get less money. Now, if you go talk to cities, counties, and schools, they all feel that they're pretty pinched as it is. So that's a difficult conversation to have. The second one is to shift between types of property, cut owner-occupied property tax by raising taxes on ag land and commercial land. I can see there'd be an obvious downside to that idea. The third is to interject outside money to offset it. And so that's where you talk about whether it's a state sales tax imposed statewide, which some others have proposed, or the governor's plan, which is at the county level, or some kind of a mechanism to interject money from the outside. Now, over time, economic growth can also help you cut property tax. Because if you have a growing tax base, you can spread the cost out more and lower the rate for everyone. But that's a longer-term answer.
I want to talk about economic development plan in a minute. But first, the sales tax decrease sunset. How does that play into this from the governor's office's perspective, your perspective?
That is a factor. That is set to happen next July. July of 27, and it would raise the sales tax back. Right now, the sales tax is 4.2%. It's due to go back up to 4.5% next July. That's in the neighborhood of maybe $120 million of new state revenue that will come in when that goes back up. It's a tax increase, but it's one that will happen automatically because of the way the law was passed. That is definitely a factor. So there are some property tax plans that are premised on the idea of using that money when it comes in a year. There are some people who have plans of why don't we raise it a year early and get the money this year. Then on the flip side, I know that there's going to be a bill coming to make that permanent so that it doesn't sunset. Just leave it at 4.2. And so that would be the extremes from one side to the other. The other factor, frankly, is there are people who are concerned about an economic downturn in the coming year and feel that we maybe need to wait and see what the revenue and expense situation looks like next year before we make that decision. That it's not wise to make that decision a year in advance.
Yeah, so lots to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you anticipate going with the governor's plan through the duration? Are there any pivots, compromises, areas that you're looking for that there might be wiggle room?
Oh, it's pretty early to say. I do think, as I said, our plan makes a lot of sense. It's getting support. It is flexible in terms of how it could work with other ideas. But this is going to be a very evolving conversation. And again, we need to see what all is there and who's supporting what, and then start talking to people about what a solution could look like that could win support in the legislature.
So let's talk about economic growth and the governor's economic development plan.
Mm-hmm.
That's very complicated, but it's getting a lot of attention right now from everything from the Future Fund to Landowner Bill of Rights mm-hmm. to big corporations coming to South Dakota to small businesses looking for support. Where do you want to begin? Now you're talking to listeners, to voters, to the average person about what state government's role is in economic development and some of the key initiatives that the state does on an ongoing basis to help grow the economy.
I think the most important thing for people to know is that we this year are having a conversation where there's a real question about what should the role be for the state in economic development. And I would just say South Dakota would look very different today if the state hadn't taken an active role in economic development over the last 50 years. You compare Sioux Falls to Sioux City, Iowa, which were the same size and had very similar economies in 1960, say. You know, pretty blue-collar, centered around a packing plant. Now Sioux Falls is far larger and more prosperous than Sioux City. At least twice as big, maybe more. Well, why is that? Well, the two key catalysts that you would point to would be the decision of the state to build a four-year medical school and to subsidize it and to put a lot of money into building up our healthcare system and our medical infrastructure, which is a huge industry in Sioux Falls now. And secondly, the initiatives to bring the finance and trust sectors to the state, which again created and diversified the economy, especially in Sioux Falls, but also elsewhere. So just that microcosm, those were not laissez-faire, we'll just wait and see what happened. Those were aggressive moves being made by the state to help incentivize that, and Sioux Falls is transformed by it. So when you want to talk about, you know, what do we need to do now, the governor talked in the State of the State address about a pivot to national security as a focus, really building on Governor Noem's focus on cybersecurity, which is a component of national security and has a huge amount of potential to be another big sector in our state, not just in Sioux Falls, but in Madison and in other places. With the B-21 bomber coming to Ellsworth, that is another key building block that there could be a lot more activity in that defense space in Rapid City. And we'll see it elsewhere in the state, too. I mean, this is a very bold, forward-looking plan for how we should be thinking about economic development going forward. What concerns me is there's this undertone this year in the legislature and in some of these bills, and some of these bills are better or worse than others, but just kind of questioning the rationale of the whole enterprise. Should we be doing this at all? And I would just say we are competing with 49 other states, practically all of which put a lot more resources behind their economic development programs than we do. And if this was a deal where no state could do anything and we all just have to compete on our tax climate and our, you know, then South Dakota would do great. But, you know, the state of Kansas just gave $4 billion to the Kansas City Chiefs to move across the border. Kansas is bigger than us, but not all, they're not New York or something. There are some states not that dissimilar from us who are putting a lot more behind this than we are. And we just got to understand, if we want to keep, go back to property tax, if you want to keep growing our tax base, this is how you do it. Economic growth brings more people, brings more housing, increases wages, brings more competition for workers, and that attracts more industry, and that's what we want. There are people who, oh, we like things the way they are. And I understand, I mean, nostalgia is a powerful force, I understand that. But it's not a, if you're not growing, you're in trouble. So and you're going to start to see stresses, you're going to see a lot of stress on state and local government if you have a pie that isn't growing. If it's stagnant or if it's shrinking, that's when things get tough. Everything is easier when you have a growing pie.
So is the push toward national security partially a desire for, you know, there's opportunities there, but then also it might be more palatable to the people who are hesitant to bring in just any corporation, but it might be something they can get their arms around because it's a national security operation? Why national security as a target area of industry, of incoming industry?
Well, I hope it's more palatable, and that might be. I don't think that was really the motivator. I think the motivator was looking at what our strengths are and where we have opportunity to move forward. And again, in South Dakota, we have the cybersecurity industry. We have ag processing, which food security is a major aspect of national security. Again, we have Ellsworth and everything that's going on around that. The Black Hills, we have a growing firearms, ammunition industry. Many of those are defense contractors. We have a couple, I mean, just last, I think it was in December, we had a company in Sioux Falls that announced a big Defense Department contract. And there are a couple other defense contractors in the state as well. So I think it's a recognition that there are pieces in place here that we can move forward with in a more strategic way.
In a post-COVID South Dakota, are there ways that the Governor's Office of Economic Development can increase transparency or provide more communication to rebuild what some people have said is a little bit of a loss of trust because of some controversies in that department? Are there ways to increase transparency from the Governor's Office of Economic Development?
We certainly support transparency, and the records of GOED, the grants and loans they do, what their programs are, the decisions they make, are all posted on their website and submitted to the legislature and have been. They're all there if you want to find them.
People want to say, did you make the best deal that you could with C.J. Schwanz?
Yeah.
You can't post the boardroom discussion of how the deal was made, but what can you do to increase people's understanding of how the deals are made?
Yeah, and in a case like that, that was a classic example of there are several sites being considered and you're working against other sites and trying to put forward the best package that you can, you know? And that's just like any negotiation where you're competing with others. You can always go back later and, you know, wonder, well, what about this, what about that? What I will say is that's a $500 million investment in the state. It's going to create good jobs. There's a possibility that it will be larger in time, and it's playing right to our strength as another food processing plant, which is an obvious sector for South Dakota to grow in. And so the controversy is what it is, but we have to recognize that. And then the High Plains soybean processing plant in Mitchell, another $500 million investment. Just those two things are I think High Plains processing, they use it for more than food, but our ag processing plants, that's $1 billion of investment right there, and good jobs and more value for our farmers. And that's what we need more of.
Do you think you're getting enough credit, for lack of a better word, for some of the successes?
I don't worry too much about credit. I think the people who pay attention realize that South Dakota's economy is very strong. I think in the last quarter, our personal income growth and GDP growth were both second in the country, I think. Our biggest challenge continues to be that there's so much demand for workers. But that's a good thing. That attracts people to the state, drives wages up and attracts people to the state. That keeps us growing. I mean, we'd like to have more workers now so we can grow faster, but in the scheme of problems to have, that's not a bad problem to have.
So former Governor Kristi Noem, who you mentioned earlier, starting some of the cybersecurity initiatives, and will be remembered that for that, will also be remembered during COVID for the leadership of keeping the state open. In some ways, that's nuanced, of course, but, you know, her advertisement, we're open for business, we'll stick with that, and freedom works here.
If you write one sentence, there's always if you write one sentence about someone's legacy, what is it? And I think that's probably hers.
The situation she's embroiled in now, though, is incredibly polarizing and probably stands to increasingly be so on the national front. How is that impacting businesses' desires to move to South Dakota or do business in South Dakota? What's the tale of that policy and of her forward-facing approach to economic development with her at the front of it?
You know, I would say while she was governor, and I, as you know, I worked for her for some of that time, not all of it, her high national profile was an asset. And she, you know, she took some flack for, oh, why are you doing these ads? But I always defended that. I always felt, here's a lady who has a high national profile. She got a lot of support, particularly during COVID, to how she approached that, not from everybody, but from a certain large segment of the people.
We were a hot spot for deaths for a long period of time. So that is the asterisk.
Yes,
but if you lost somebody during that time, it is not an asterisk.
Of course. But my point is that she developed a very high profile and a national following during that time and was smart to leverage that to promote our state. And I think with a lot of success. We saw people moving here. We saw businesses moving here. And they were attracted here because of her. They liked her. They liked her policies. They liked her message. Again, that's not 100% of the United States, but we don't need all 300 million people to move here, right? That was clearly the case. You know, now she's in the job she's in, and that is a difficult job, to say the least. I certainly don't want to trade jobs with her. I don't know that it affects how people view South Dakota at this point. I think she's kind of operating on a different plane now. And I suppose if you ask people what state is she from, some of them remember that she's from South Dakota, but that's not the game she's playing anymore. She's on a whole nother level.
So it won't have an impact, you believe? You're not hearing an impact and you don't predict one. Is that what I hear you saying correctly?
Yeah, As I said, I think while she was governor, her national profile, definitely she leveraged it to help promote our state and was successful at that. Her being in the job she's in now, again, very difficult job, difficult issues, lots of controversy, in the news a lot. I don't think very many people see that and think, oh, this makes me think more or less of South Dakota. Any more than, the attack on Venezuela makes me think less of Marco Rubio because he's from Florida, so I don't like Florida. I just don't think people see national figures in those terms.
Rural Health Transformation Project.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking, we talk about COVID and the healthcare infrastructure that we had, which mm-hmm. I think is another, when we look back.
It's a really big deal.
Maybe not talked about enough on how mm-hmm. strong that infrastructure actually was.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about where we're at with the Rural Health Transformation Project. From a listener, if you're living in rural South Dakota right now and you're wondering what's next, give me the freshman version of that program and what's going to happen.
Yeah, and I would say, to preface it a little, and you kind of mentioned this, South Dakota has a really good healthcare system. Of course, in Sioux Falls and in Rapid City, but throughout the state. And that's really important. You know, at that time, I assume this is still true, South Dakota had the most hospital beds per capita of any state in the country, which gave us more of an ability to withstand that, you know, those initial waves of COVID. We just had more infrastructure per capita than other states did. So that was a strength that we have. Of course, our health systems, the large health systems and the big hospitals are excellent. But in the rural, you know, I grew up in Armour. I was born in Douglas County Memorial Hospital, which at one time was the smallest hospital in the state. I don't know if that's still true. Governor Roden is from Union Center. We both have an appreciation for rural health care and why that's important. So this money was part of the big, beautiful bill. It's a lot of money. You know, our first year allocation is $189 million. Over 5 years, we anticipate we'll get about $1 billion. It's interesting in the way they structured it because small states like South Dakota get a lot more money per capita than big states do. So good for us. And we're using it in a smart way because we know that these are dollars that we're going to have for 5 years and then they're going to be gone. So you don't put it into ongoing costs. We're not going to raise rates. We're not going to raise salaries because you don't want to be 5 years and now you fall off a cliff. But what can you do? You can invest in new technology and infrastructure, improve the ability for telemedicine, try to do some programs during that five-year period to recruit more healthcare workers to those rural areas. A lot of these rural areas, you know, they always struggle to get workers, and then their workforces are aging. So we need a new generation of doctors and nurses and PAs and, you know, everybody to go into these places and stay there once the 5 years is up. EMS, helping modernize the ambulance services. There are a lot of things that we can do over this next 5 years that'll make a really big difference. That's important for quality of life in these rural areas, really important. Mm-hmm. It's also, frankly, a lot of places the health system is the largest employer or maybe in competition with the school. And so for a lot of these little towns, keeping those health facilities viable is keeping the town viable. Mm-hmm. That's certainly true. The governor and I went visited Armour, my hometown, and I don't know if it's the largest employer, but it's between it and the school. And it'd be a real blow to that town if they ever lost it.
What it's like to have a baby, our maternal health numbers are not great as far as infant loss. Mm-hmm. Are there targeted areas to try to improve access to maternal health care?
That is an important issue. One of the big problems we have right now is West River. We have OB in Pierre and Chamberlain and then all the way to Rapid City. And I know that the health systems are looking at ways that we can work together to improve that. You know, some residency programs might be part of the answer there. Some of that could be done with rural health transformation money, some of it perhaps outside of that. You know, now that Sanford has announced that they're building a hospital in Rapid City, their footprint now includes West River. They used to be that they only went to Chamberlain, so mm-hmm. they were really not West River, but now they are. That could make a difference. An underappreciated aspect of that is that you also need anesthesia. Yeah. You need that if you're going to do deliveries too.
Yeah.
And that it's hard to get an anesthesiologist to.
There's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah.
For the future of South Dakota, when we look at a vision of the future beyond nostalgia, there is work to be done.
That's right.
I'm going to ask you if there's anything else that you want to talk about before we close, but I also wanted to let listeners know we'll play a little audio of you on the floor of the Senate explaining the role of Lieutenant Governor in breaking a tie.
Yes.
In the Senate, because there is an illness and a senator is out. And so there could be many times that this comes up with legislation.
Right.
For people who didn't see that exchange on the floor of the Senate, and we're going to play the audio of the educational part, so you don't mm-hmm. have to repeat that. But I'm wondering, as a leadership moment for you, you talked about, you know, Senator Chris Carr is pushing back and saying, I disagree with you. I want to continue my appeal. Mm-hmm. I do believe that you are wrong. And you said, my job is to come here and do this in a fair and dispassionate way. Take us into that moment when you're mm-hmm. up there looking out at the senators and explaining your thought process and hearing them push back and vote it down.
Yeah, well, I take my job as president of the Senate very seriously, and it's important that I am fair and even-handed and open to criticism, frankly, and that's how I tried to handle that situation. So Senator Carr had told me right before session that he'd be challenging my ruling, and we talked about how that procedure would work, so I thought he also handled it in a fair way. My job is to make the best ruling I can make. I have researched that question, and I believe that the ruling I made was based on the precedent that has been set in the Senate for a very long time and is consistent with other states. I can see his argument. It's not an illegitimate argument. I can see why you could read this two different ways. I had to pick one side or the other. I picked the one that I thought was the stronger argument based on precedent. It is his right to challenge it. It's the right of the Senate then to take a vote on which one they want to uphold. And we have now asked the Supreme Court for an advisory opinion, and my hope is that they rule quickly and give us an answer so we all know what the rules of the game are and we can move forward. And frankly, if I had the choice between them adopting my interpretation in a year or adopting Senator Carr's interpretation today, I would pick that. I want an answer quick. I think it's better for everybody if we know what the rules are and we can all live under the same rules. That's important. That's my job as president of the Senate.
We interviewed a third-year law student who was part of the rural for the Public Service Pathway Program at USD School of Law, and she was talking about giving the opening arguments in a murder trial in Pennington County and handling her nerves and shifting to one foot and then realizing, maybe I shouldn't shift to one foot. I'm still a little nervous. So were you nervous during that exchange?
No, I don't think I was.
Would you have been if you were a third-year law student?
Maybe if I was a third-year law student, I would have been. But at this point, for one thing, a whole other topic is, the other day I had to stand for 3 hours. So strategies for standing for long periods of time are kind of an underappreciated aspect of being president of the Senate or speaker of the House. We have a foam pad up there to stand on, so it's a little easier on your feet. I guess at this point in my life, I've had enough time standing in front of people and making arguments, and I'm comfortable doing that.
Foam pad, what else? Strategies for standing for 3 hours?
There is a little stool to stand on, but neither Speaker Hansen or I need, we're both tall enough that we don't have to use the stool. But I've always thought I move around a lot up there, back and forth and doing whatever, and I've always thought it would be much harder if I had to stand on this little stool. I think I would fall off. I'm glad I'm tall enough that I don't have to do it.
Any other thoughts that you wanted to, that are on your mind today?
No, if we're down to the stool at the front of the Senate, I think we've probably exhausted our topics.
You know I can keep going. Don't challenge me. But we'll leave it at that. That's Lieutenant Governor Tony Venhuizen, and that is our conversation for today. We hope that it served you. I'm going to leave you with an audio excerpt from the conversation on the Senate floor between Lieutenant Governor Tony Venhuizen and Senator Chris Carr, so you have easy access to the full conversation about the Lieutenant Governor's role in the Senate. I reached out to Chief Justice Stephen Jensen with the South Dakota Supreme Court about the timeline for the advisory opinion. He said that the court has asked for briefing from the governor and the Senate by next Wednesday. That's February 4th. From all of us here at STPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.
Motions and resolutions.
Mr. President. Senator Carr.
Thank you, Mr. President. Yesterday we had Senate Bill 25, and I made a point of order that was not resolved with the ruling. We were pressed for time. We had a very important ceremony to attend, and I'd like to pick up where we left off with that point of order. My point of order is such that the president, the lieutenant governor serving as the president of the Senate, is not able to break a tie in a matter when there's final passage involved.
Okay, so that is your point of order. The way this works is I'll make a ruling, and then if Senator Carter disagrees with my ruling, he can challenge it. I want you to know that I have researched this extensively even before yesterday, because it's, of course, something that will come up sooner or later, particularly when we have one senator absent due to illness. That situation happened once before in the 1937 South Dakota State Senate, back when they had 45 members and there was an ill member and had 22-22 ties with some frequency. Senator Carr is correct in that there are two provisions of the state constitution that have to be reconciled. One provision states that final passage requires a vote of a majority of members elect. The other provision says that the lieutenant governor is president of the Senate but shall not vote except in the case of a tie. How do you reconcile these? This has never been litigated in South Dakota. There's no case law on it. There are a number of canons of statutory or constitutional construction that you use when you are reconciling two constitutional provisions. One of them is to look at the original intent of the framers of the document. That would be the framers of the 1889 South Dakota Constitution. The records of their debates do not include anything about these two, the meaning of these two, or how they were meant to be in concert. There's no record of that. However, it was in the rules of the 1890 Senate, the first Senate that convened after the Constitutional Convention, which included senators who had been members of that Constitutional Convention, that the president would have the power to vote in the case of a tie. That was the rule from the very first Senate. It has been the practice and the precedent ever since statehood. As I think was stated, the last time that a president voted to break a tie to pass a bill was Senate Bill 169, which was in the 2010 legislative session. That was Lieutenant Governor Dennis Dugard. It should also be noted, I think, that at the time of statehood and through to today, the Senate has always had an odd number of members. It used to be 45, today it's 35, but there was never a scenario where it was an even number of members. So the situation that is before us here has been present since statehood. Another canon of constitutional construction is to look at the structure of the document. In the case of our Constitution, the South Dakota Senate and the role of the Lieutenant Governor as President is modeled after the Constitution of the United States, where the U.S. Senate is presided over by the Vice President, who has a tie-breaking vote. And in that case, as in this one, 50 senators, which is not a majority, 50 senators plus the Vice President is sufficient for final passage on any action. So it is consistent with that federal practice, which is goes to the structure. A third canon of constitutional construction is that when you have a more specific and a more general provision, the more specific controls. And in this case, we have a general provision about all bills, and then we have a specific provision about what to do in the case of a tie. Finally, there is a canon of construction called the presumption against surplusage. Surplusage meaning that you should presume that every passage, every phrase in the Constitution is meant to have some meaning. And if the language saying that the Lieutenant Governor votes in the case of a tie does not apply because of the requirement of members-elect, it would raise the question, why is it there at all? Why did they put it there? What was it meant to do? Given the lack of case law on this topic in South Dakota, I referred to Mason's Manual, which is the like the Roberts Rules of Order for the state legislature, Mason's Manual section 513 sub 2 says, in some instances, provisions are made to break a tie. This is accomplished by giving the presiding officer a vote in the case of a tie. This is called a casting vote. Such a vote can only be cast when it will decide a tie. And then sub 4 says, when not a member of the body, the presiding officer can cast a vote only when expressly authorized to do so. Finally, in the absence of any legislative or any legal authority in South Dakota, you look to other states who have had similar cases arise. The state of Michigan's constitution has identical language to ours in both of these provisions. And a 1978 advisory opinion of the Michigan Supreme Court ruled that the lieutenant governor could vote yes to give final passage to a bill, even though their constitution, like ours, has the members-elect language. Those are the reasons for my ruling. That's the research that I've done. I would also like you to know the only way to ever get a judicial decision on this question is for this bill to pass and reach the governor's desk. The governor has the authority to seek an advisory opinion of the Supreme Court as to questions about his power. The lieutenant governor does not have that authority. I do not have the authority to seek an advisory opinion about my power. Only the governor does. So to receive any kind of judicial clarification here, one of two things would have to happen. Either the bill passes and the governor asks for an advisory opinion, or the bill passes and is signed into law, and then someone challenges the law's validity and it gets to the Supreme Court. Those are the only two paths that are available. Otherwise, it will remain unresolved judicially. So those are the reasons for my ruling. I want to lay them out very clearly. I told you on the day I was sworn in as Lieutenant Governor that I would do the best I could to run this chamber and I would do it to the best of my ability and the best of my understanding, but I was always open to your input and criticism, and when that happened, we would figure it out in a fair and dispassionate way, and that is what I'm attempting to do. So that is my ruling. Senator Carr, do you wish to challenge my ruling?
Mr. President, I do wish to challenge your ruling. I'd like to make comments.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Nobody disputes the professionalism, the integrity that you've brought to this position in presiding. And I don't dispute the things that you stated regarding the Masons or Congress, but this is, and you've talked about the bill. This isn't about the bill. It's not a question about the bill. It's a question about the institution here and the separation of powers, the executive branch and the legislative branch. The thing that separates us from Congress is we do have that second provision that does state that a majority of all members elected to each house of the legislature in a Senate of 35 members, an equal division of members elect would be 17 and one half. The Lieutenant Governor is not a member of the Senate even when acting in the capacity of President of the Senate, still not an elected member. I believe we would be in conflict of the Constitution if we do not have 18 members elect voting in the affirmative. You know, you asked why this language would be in here. And I think about our process and the short time frame we have and what this applies to. This applies to final passage or items that would require the members elect. There's other items that we take up and we vote on that don't have that requirement. It's members present. And I agree that in the Constitution, it allows for the Lieutenant Governor, when acting as the President of the Senate, to break those ties. And I think that's there to make sure that we can keep our regular business going and keep things moving along. But when it comes to final passage of a bill from this chamber of senators that were elected, it requires a majority of members elect. And I think the Constitution's clear on that. So that's why I'm appealing your ruling respectfully.
Thank you. Any further remarks? Hearing no further remarks, the question before the Senate is Senator Carr's motion to appeal the ruling of the chair on the, actually the president, on the president's vote on Senate Bill 25 on the seventh legislative day. To be clear, a yes vote supports Senator Carr's motion. A no vote supports the ruling of the president. I want to make sure that's perfectly clear. This is a roll call vote. The question before the Senate is Senator Carr's appeal of the ruling of the President. When your name is called, those in favor vote aye, those opposed nay. The Secretary will call the roll.
Senators Beal, excused, Blanc,
yes.
Carly,
aye.
Crabtree,
nay.
Davis,
no.
Dibert,
aye.
Duhamel,
no.
Foster, Grove,
aye.
Hone,
aye.
Howard,
aye.
Hulse,
aye.
Jensen,
aye.
Carr,
aye.
Colbeck,
aye.
Lapke,
aye.
Larson,
aye.
Marty,
aye.
Melhoff,
aye.
Ms. Gimmons,
no.
Nelson,
aye.
Otten,
aye.
Perry, Peterson,
aye.
Pischke,
aye.
Reed,
no.
Roll,
no.
Souter,
no.
Shanefish,
no.
Smith,
aye.
Vilhauer,
no.
Voigt,
aye.
Voida,
aye.
Whip,
no.
Zickman,
aye.
Blanc, Mr. President, we have 24 yeas, 10 nays, with one excused.
So the question, having received a majority vote of the members elect, the challenge is sustained.